Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Welcome back to Barton and Bud. I'm Barton Simmons with Bud Elliott, and we are going to do a mailbag today. Bud, we did a little bit of a playoff preview that's coming. We're recording it right now as like Wake Forest, I think, is like putting it on Wisconsin. That's 14-7 now. But we're gonna poke around. Look, I think we got some old questions because Apple's kind of screwing us, and we're not getting the new ones in. But we're gonna dig into some old questions that are some good ones and some evergreen ones and play around this a little bit.
Let's do it, man. As a reminder, even though Apple is screwing us as far as our ability to see the podcast review questions, you can still submit your podcast reviews. Apple has assured the podcasting industry that we will eventually see them. So if you want to, you know, keep submitting those, that's awesome. Keep hitting us up with those 5-star ratings and reviews. Always appreciate it. I'm pretty proud we're able to get 750. In our maiden voyage, despite the fact that for a lot of the offseason, it wasn't totally certain that we were even going to play ball this year. And I'm very glad that we did. Let's lead this thing off. Most of these questions came from the part of the Apple podcast that we could actually see. And then a couple y'all hit us up on Twitter. Very kind of you to do so. And this actually referenced something that you said in the show. So some Miami fans disagreed with this and some fans liked it and others were intrigued. So let's go ahead and tackle this. And Valhalla 24 writes, "Hey, hearing Barton say Vatek is a better coaching job than Miami and UNC makes me wonder, what are the top 10-ish jobs in the country and what are some underrated and overrated coaching jobs and what all comes into play when considering this?"
All right. You want to start? You want me to start? I got a couple in mind.
All right. So I think top 10 is a very arbitrary number of jobs, right? Like I kind of think there are, I don't know that I would group it with 10. You know, I think 10-ish, like he asks, is more appropriate. Because there's a couple in each conference which I feel like you can win a national title if things go right. You know.
So how are we defining top jobs? I think that's a good place to start. What do we?
It's a great question.
What is our criteria here?
Let's just look at it first from the perspective, like any job. You want to make money. You want to make sure your family's secure. You want to go a place where if you do a good job, you get recognized for doing a good job. So your expectations and definitions of success are, I would say, reasonable relative to the resources of the program. But all those things being equal, and the pay at a lot of these jobs is much better than it used to be. So it's not like one place can pay you $20 million to the head coach and the next place can pay you $2 million. TV money has changed the game in many ways. Like pretty much all Power 5 jobs now are paying pretty damn good money. But here, I think the best jobs are the ones that have the ability to win it all. You know, that's not to say Northwestern's not a great job or Kentucky, which I think is an awesome job given that they're very realistic about their expectations for their head coach relative to their resources. Those are great jobs in my opinion, but I do think the top 10 jobs, if you're a competitor, man, like you want to win at the highest level. You know, it's not to say you don't have to get your start somewhere and somewhere a little bit lower, but don't you want to be at that top level to compete? I think. So I think Bama is a top job. Ohio State is a top job. obviously everybody's always interested in Texas.
I don't know if I'd put Texas in there.
Right, because there, I think there's something about Texas that, because I'm not in that Texas program, that makes me wonder why don't they win more at Texas? We've talked about that on this show before. Oklahoma doesn't have quite the resources Texas does, but I think it has better, like, get the hell out of the way than Texas does, and just lets their coaches cook. For USC to still attract the talent that it does, despite all the dysfunction in that program, I think indicates it probably is still a top job. And
yeah, I think
maybe the only one on the West Coast that I'd put there.
Mm-hmm.
Clemson basically saying screw you to all the other sports that they play to dump all their money into football indicates that they're all in on the sport of football. I think Florida's a top job. LSU's a top job. Georgia's a top job. Then
I might go Michigan in there, because the thing about Michigan, they've had some issues winning it all there, but I think that they can, and I think that there is a level of I think they've shown a level of commitment to Jim Harbaugh that is encouraging for as a coach looking for opportunities. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah.
I think that there might be a little bit lower ceiling on Michigan than some of the other programs because of some of the academic issues and things of that nature. But I still think there's a little more patience there. They've proven than some other places. And I would put Notre Dame in there too. I mean, Notre Dame, you are still, you know, wake up the echoes. Like, you're still that historic program. And yes, academic issues are there, but like, you're as much of a national brand as anyone in college football. And I think all that stuff still kind of matters.
Do you put Penn State on the same level as Michigan?
The thing with Penn State is I feel like there's geographical obstacles there. Like, it's just hard to get to State College.
Yeah.
I was scarred by my trip there when I went there a couple of years ago for the Whiteout game against Ohio State. Once there, unbelievable. Like, the atmosphere, the fan like energy and excitement, the resources that they have, the alumni network, there are some ridiculous advantages that they have at Penn State. So I don't know, maybe those outweigh that geographical issue, but like it I just, the hotel I stayed in was like an hour outside of State College. Like, it was just no real air, like, there's an airport in State College, but I don't know, there's not a lot of flights flying into it. And so I just, given where it's located in central Pennsylvania, you know, the talent around it, that they're borderline for me.
So that's fair. I also would say the Hokies are also really hard to get to. Not quite as difficult to get to as Penn State is, but
they're in your opinion, is Virginia's like driving footprint more, is Blacksburg's like 4-hour driving radius more talented than Penn State's? Maybe that's not, but I envision it as it is. I got to look at a map and make sure that's a fair assessment. But I feel
let me pull up the map here just so I can kind of draw a little 4-hour circle of driving around here. But I like where you're going with this. I think you're right, but there's also some pretty big metropolitan areas that I think are within 4 hours of State College.
Mm-hmm.
So I could be wrong about that, which is why luckily we have Google.
I'm looking this up too. All right, so you got like you.
Which one are you looking up? Are you looking at Penn State or looking up UVA?
I'm looking
or
up
UV Tech.
I'm looking up Virginia Tech.
All right, I'll
just
look up
curious.
Penn State.
So Virginia Tech, you got, you're in the DMV's right up the road. You got Cincinnati to the west. You can get down to Charlotte to the south. It's not exactly, you know, you can kind of go north or south there. But it's probably still hard to recruit nationally there.
I think it definitely is. So, you know, Philly is easily a 4-hour drive to Pennsylvania. Pittsburgh is a pretty reasonable drive to State College. Baltimore and the DC area is a fairly, wonder if that's a 4-hour drive. I would think so, but Baltimore State College, Pennsylvania is, 3 hours and 15 minutes. So 4-hour drive is pretty reasonable, because if a family leaves their house at 7 a.m., they're on your college campus at 11. Okay, they can spend 4, 5, 6 hours there. They leave at 5. They're still home by 9. You don't necessarily have to hotel it. That's why coaches traditionally have used the kind of 4-hour rule, because that's a day trip. And, you know, for a lot of these lower income families, hotel is a fairly big deal, right? It's more money to the trip and, you know, gas money, the expense of actually driving somewhere. I think because so much of that 4 hours around Virginia Tech is like national forest, West Virginia, very country, not a lot of people. You know what I mean? I think 4 hour might be better for State College.
That's fair. You may be right.
But I don't think it's huge, because if you look at north of State College, there's nothing, man. I mean, it's the Allegheny National Forest. I'm having to zoom in a lot on Google Maps just to find another city to pop up. Like, it shows Buffalo, but that's going to be probably six and a half hours away, and there's not that much talent in Buffalo, New York. I mean, we don't rank a whole lot of kids from Bradford, Pennsylvania, or Wellsboro, or Montoursville. At this point, I could probably make up cities in Pennsylvania to see if Barton will nod along to see it. how about Cowdersport or the Susquehannock National Forest is directly north of State College. So both of these schools definitely have an issue of, you know, kind of like Tallahassee school I'm very familiar with. There's not a whole lot of kids who live in the Gulf of Mexico. And that's very much included in their 4-hour radius there, down there. So they all kind of have surrounding talent issues. Who are some jobs that in your mind are either underrated or overrated, and why?
I'll give you a couple underrated. Cincinnati is a good job. Otherwise, Luke Fickell would be gone by now. I mean, think about the coaches that have come through there, whether it's Brian Kelly, Butch Jones, Luke Fickell, Tommy Tuberville failed there, but Tommy Tuberville was going to fail anywhere probably at that point in his career. That's a group of five job that you can sort of stick with and win there, and you've got resources and you've got recruiting base. And so I think that's a good job. I think Baylor is a good job. You're in Texas. You can evaluate the way you want to. You don't have to get in the arms race with Texas and A&M and Oklahoma for the five stars. You can develop those guys. You've got academics that you can sell, but it's not so restrictive that you can't get guys in. They actually want to win there. I mean, they kind of want to win in every sport. Like they put resources into basketball and they put resources into football. They got a nice stadium, all that sort of stuff. So I think Baylor is a good job. This is going to be very homerish what I say here, but like, I think Vanderbilt is a good job. I think it is, because think about it, like they've had three coaches since 2002, basically. I mean, they had an interim coach. Bobby Johnson retired there after going like playing like 8 years there, had a 1-7-win season, and he's like a legend and is on the College Football Playoff committee, right? You got James Franklin, who won 9 games there, 2 years, went 3 straight bowls, and got a head job at Penn State. And you got Derek Mason that's gone, you know, 7 years without a winning season. And so I if you want to win national titles, yeah, that's a tough place. But you can live in a great city. You have a great recruiting base. You have reasonable expectations, and I think if you kind of position yourself the right way, you can recruit some really good players there. So I think that's a better job than it gets credit for, but that could be very much a homer pick.
Well, it could be a homer pick and be right. I think the big thing there that you mentioned is the patience element, right? And the biggest thing that I think creates underrated and overrated jobs is expectations relative to resources and the speed that those expectations are expected to be met. We've talked about the Kentucky thing here. I think Kentucky is...
Yeah, that was another one I had.
Kind of arguably the best job in the SEC among the non-national title contenders, because they have actually... They've put their money where their mouth is. They say, Mark Stoops, you win seven games in a year, we automatically extend your contract by 1 year and give you the percentage bump too. If you win 10, you get an automatic two-year extension on top of that. So Kentucky has said, hey, we've defined what success here is at Kentucky. We don't expect you to beat Florida and Georgia and all that kind of stuff. Now, they did make a move at offensive coordinator, probably because they want to sell some tickets, and being the worst throw-in team in the SEC a couple years running is tough. And we discussed that when Eddie Grant got let go probably 4 or 5 episodes now. So I have that one as an underrated job. I agree with you on Baylor and a couple of those other ones. I think Oklahoma State is kind of an underrated job. I mean, Mike Gundy, the amount of jobs he has flirted with and not left for tells me that that's probably a pretty good place to work overall, and that they haven't fired him for doing so. You know, basically, look, they're cool with you doing your own thing there, and it seems like they're pretty patient. It's been probably 4 years now since their AD made the comments about Mike Gundy's recruiting, and I haven't heard anything more about that from him. Now, jobs that I think are, you can, by the way, be a good job and still be an overrated job. I think we should point that out. Like, Miami is a good job. It's also a job in which they won basically all the games they were expected to win this year for the first time in quite a while, that they didn't really have any huge letdown games in terms of the result. Now, getting blown the hell out by UNC was a letdown. But it's also a COVID year, man. They've had a bunch of guys out and practice has been weird. But their expectations down there are national title. And I'm not convinced that's super realistic unless you get like a Trevor Lawrence type QB, given their commitment and resources and what they pay. I think Texas is probably a bit of an overrated job. Everybody says it's an awesome job, but yet they've won, what, 2 conference titles in the last 2 decades? Now, one of them was a natty, but that's expectations that don't necessarily match up. Tennessee and Nebraska are probably also, you know, 2 interesting jobs. And I have thought about this. If Chris Winkie does not break his neck, Tennessee almost certainly does not win the national title, because they were pretty close in that game in which they, you know, got to face the backup to the Heisman Trophy winner. Does Tennessee have more realistic expectations if Fulmer does not win that title that year with T. Martin?
That's a good point. They probably do.
I think it's a better job if they didn't win it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, but because they got the hardware 21 years ago, you know, like now I think they think they can get back there. And that was a very unique circumstance in time. I mean, Saban was not really in the league at that point, and like not in the dominant fashion that, you know, that he would come to be. You know, Georgia was still screwing around. They had not hired, I don't think they had hired Rick at that point yet. So, you know, Florida was Spurrier, but kind of at the point when Spurrier was starting to not like recruiting anymore. It was just a very unique point in time. So I think Tennessee is a bit of an overrated job. Additionally, with all the, you know, behind the scenes stuff there, that their coaching search was an absolute disaster, and you basically had a coup that resulted in a new AD. And in Nebraska a little bit too. I'll go ahead and give you guys a bit of a preview on this. I'm working on a project that says that AD should have more patience, not less, in the early signing period era, because basically all these classes that these new coaches sign, unless they're an internal hire, are freaking disasters. Okay, I'm going to read you off this real fast, and I'm not going to share all the data because I don't want somebody to aggregate my podcast comments and turn that into an article before I have time to turn it out.
Your story.
Yeah. All right. How many guys from your first class that you signed, so your short season class, are still on your roster? And I'm including opt-outs in this as being on the roster because they're technically still on the roster. Like, they haven't left. And if you went to the NFL early, I still counted you as being on the roster for this. And if you're a JUCO, two to play two, I counted you as still being okay, because that's like, you know, your eligibility was fulfilled.
All right, so you're giving some benefits of the doubt here.
Yeah, this is, okay. I'm trying to give all the benefits of the doubt. Okay. FSU, 9 of 21. Florida, 11 of 20.
These are still on the roster.
Still on the roster, yeah, for this season. Texas A&M, 9 of 23. Nebraska, 10 of 25. I mean, dude, now UCLA, interestingly, 21 of 27. Kind of funky there, which suggests they might be a little bit better team next year than we think.
Yeah.
Nebraska, man, has made a real effort to recruit Florida under Scott Frost and some of these other states. And the guys they signed out of these states, a ton of them are gone. Like, their attrition has been sky high. So I'm going to go ahead and put Nebraska as a bit of an overrated job on this list as well.
Yeah, this Scott Frost stuff has shook me, because I really thought that was a great hire, and it still might be. I mean, let's not pull the ripcord on it just yet, but it has been evident that it is it's just because he was at Oregon and UCF, and he's won a lot of games, and he's a iconic sort of name for that program, doesn't necessarily mean that there's going to automatically be able to sort of steal the guys that other people want out of a place like Florida. And so I still think the geographic challenges remain. The modern landscape is there, in which everyone has national visibility, not just Nebraska, who's the only team playing on national television every weekend. Like, I agree. I think Nebraska is suddenly, the ceiling appears to be much lower than it once was.
By the way, there is a big difference, and I don't want to give away the whole piece. There is a big difference in attrition levels between the guys who were hired from outside the program and their first transition classes and the guys who were internal hires. So like Lincoln Riley, Ryan Day, Mario Cristobal, those dudes have not had this level of attrition. And my theory on this is that I think that they knew who they were getting and knew who they wanted to get. And they already had relationships with these guys because they were already recruiting them. A lot of times these staffs, when they first get there, they're scrambling to put together that first class. And with the early signing period, it has kind of microwaved that timetable in which you have to meet these dudes. So, I mean, and sometimes these four stars you get are four-star physical talents, but they're available to you for a reason, and not a good reason, a bad reason. And they end up washing out of your program, and you look back as a staff and you say, well, I guess there was probably a reason we were able to get that kid despite only being here for 10 days.
Yeah. There's a mistake there. If you just are trying to get a few four stars in the boat to make your rankings look good, that ain't it. That's going to be a problem down the road.
Yeah. So if I'm an AD, I'm looking at these numbers and I'm saying, man, if I'm making a new hire and I'm not making an internal promotion, it's a legit 4 to 5 year process, because your first class, you're probably not going to get a damn thing from. Florida, 15 of their 22 starters are from the high school classes of 16 and 17. You believe that? Only 7 of the guys who start for them were signed by Mullen out of high school.
Wow.
Like, that's pretty shocking.
Yeah.
But I think it shows how tough this eval process is with this updated timetable.
For sure.
Which is way off the rails for that question, but sometimes we do that.
Let's see. Let me take the next one here.
Yeah, take cool kid 0123.
Mailbag question. As a BC fan, Jeff Hafley has me as excited as I've been since Matt Ryan left campus. Between seeing the defense improve dramatically, as well as building out the off-field staff and hiring promising assistants, I see things moving in the right direction. Recruiting is picking up, especially some of the early things I'm seeing and hearing about 2022. My question is, how much progress is possible for a program like BC? Our last period of relative success feels like such a different era in college football, but I've never seen the level of commitment from a school that I'm seeing now, from the school that I'm seeing now. Obviously, being in the Atlantic Division caps things, but is hoping for 8 or 9 wins a year reasonable?
So, just to remind the audience that the last era of success for BC was pretty much the Jeff Jagodzinski, first year Frank Spaziani, last year or last 2 years of Tom O'Brien there. They went 9-3 in 04, 9-3 in 05, 10-3 in 06, 11-3 in 07, 9-5 in 08. So I kind of want to tackle this in two ways. First, I want to tackle this with what is possible for BC if BC controls its own controllables. Because I think there's a certain number there, and then I think there's a certain thing that's possible if some other programs around them sort of fall apart, right? You have to recall that the era in which BC was winning 9 or 10 games a year, yes, it was in the ACC, but that was in the very latter years of the Bobby Bowden era, in which Florida State was kind of a mess, and Louisville had not yet joined the league in that division. And Clemson did not yet have Dabo Swinney cooking there. It was the latter years of Tommy Bowden, who would be fired. Miami was also going through the latter part of the Larry Coker years, which did not go very well once he kind of ran out of Butch Davis's players. And I believe 07 was probably Randy Shannon's first year, I think, if I recall. So I think Jeff Hadley's doing an awesome job. I know in our recruiting rankings meetings, we've noted, man, look at this kid. BC was one of the first offers there. Look, BC offered this kid first, or one of the early ones on there. They were very high on, was it Trevin Wallace, the linebacker? They were one of the first ones on him.
Yep. And I'm committed.
Yeah. So I think they're doing a great job of player evaluation. They've clearly hit on the quarterback position with the transfer. But it's still BC. And your recruiting is probably not going to be better than about fifth in the ACC, even if you are recruiting your butts off. I think controlling your controllables, even if the teams around you are good, I think you can win 7 games at BC. 8 or 9 consistently, I think, requires teams around you faltering. So if that's not Clemson faltering, that's Louisville taking a step back. That's NC State not doing what they did this year under Dave Doran. That's, you know, Florida State not improving under Mike Norvell. There's too many programs that if you're operating at peak efficiency and they're operating at peak efficiency, that they're going to have better players than you are that are on your schedule every year. That's kind of my take on that.
Yeah, Adazio was just like a perennial 6-6, 7-5 coach. And I think Adazio is a competent, capable coach, but I don't think he's like a great coach. And so the idea that Jeff Hafley can be like a great coach and potentially level that program up to 8 wins, 9 wins sometimes, absolutely. I think that that's reasonable. I think the other thing that's encouraging with Jeff Hafley, first of all, I think he's a modern coach in the sense of he understands the way you have to cultivate a roster, the way you have to build meaningful relationships. I think he is a coach that can maintain continuity on his coaching staff and stability because he's that kind of coach. I think he is a coach that will be able to, and look, I think he already has built a strong staff. And again, I think that goes back to just sort of the way he approaches things and the ability to recruit and sustain talent, you know, on the, within the football building. And so, I think all those things have me very optimistic about Boston College, and I acknowledge that there probably is a fairly hard ceiling on it. But Michigan's always dipping into New England to try to recruit land these Don Brown talents. And I don't see any reason why Boston College can't start being the team that those guys want to go to, A, and B, being able to find their sweet spots in the Atlanta area or Georgia or wherever and pulling the right guys up. But I'm very optimistic about Jeff Hafley.
Ditto. I guess I'll close it. 8 wins a year is probably a good, you know, good goal. 9 wins a year, there's a big difference between 8 and 9. Like that 8 and 9 is that's a really big difference. Just as kind of there's a difference between the teams that manage to win 3 and the teams that only win, you know, 1 or 2. Like Rutgers this year. So 73 Mustang asks us, hey guys, love the show, been listening since the summer, and it's made me a much smarter college ball fan this fall. Thanks. My question has to do with Demarcus Bowman transferring to UF. I know a little late for this question, but with the criticism that Mullen has taken from recruiting, I'm wondering how much different the UF 2020 class would be talked about if Bowman signed in December. Would it have been a top 5 class, and would it have shifted some of the narrative on Mullen's recruiting and the talent gap with Georgia?
Like, that's your wheelhouse, bud.
Yeah. So I'm going to actually pull this up. Can we still class calculator a prior class?
I think so.
Let me see if I can play with our tool here. I've actually never tried to do this, but I'm going to.
You going to a Florida class?
I am. I'm going to put Bowman in the 2020 Florida class. Yeah. Perfect. All right. So I'm calculating. If you put Bowman in the Florida 2020 class, they actually move up 7 points. They go from 273 to 281.6. So then I'm going to go to team rankings and pull that up. 281.6 would not have put Florida in the top five. It would have made them number seven instead of number nine, where they were. So I think there's a couple ways we can take this question. Number one is the value of a transfer. For instance, we had this discussion early in February, or whenever we started this podcast, probably what, April, May, when we were doing the transfer class rankings. And for the most part, you have to look at transfers with a bit of a skeptical eye, because usually they're not transferring for reasons that make them better players. Now, that's different if it's a grad transfer who has proven his worth and he's looking to transfer out. You know, maybe a guy at Arkansas State is looking to transfer to Georgia or something like that. But generally, transfers are going to be rated lower when they hit the portal than they were out of high school, simply because if you're transferring, you have to take into account as an evaluator the fact that this didn't work out for a reason. And if you look at the track record of guys who were at Clemson and transfer elsewhere, it's not great, right? Like, if you don't work out at Clemson, more often than not, you don't work out elsewhere. That's not to say DeMarcus Bowman won't work out at Florida. I don't know why he transferred. It could have been homesickness. Let's just go with that. Like, would you still consider him a five-star type transfer? He's only 1 year removed from whatever we rated him. I wasn't on rankings council last year, but it's interesting. What do you think about the Bowman transfer there?
Honestly, if I had to re-rank right now, or like rank him as a transfer, our five-star rating starts at 98. I would probably dock him down to like a 97. I still think his talent is tremendous, but he wasn't like part. I do think part of the reason he transferred, like, he wasn't getting on the field as much as he wanted to. And that doesn't, like, that's not atypical. I mean, Bijan Robinson didn't get on the field in the early part of the year either for Texas. And look what he's done in the Alamo Bowl once he like finally got the confidence of the coaching staff to get a full workload. So I don't mean to say that as a somehow dismissive of what DeMarcus Bowman will be, but I think it's our first little hint. And he wasn't like banging on the door for playing time necessarily. So that said, I think it doesn't change necessarily the narrative of what Dan Mullen has to do on the recruiting trail, right? To get a transfer and DeMarcus, Justin Shorter, whoever it is, that can help. Valuable, and maybe those guys are first-round picks eventually, which is great. But it doesn't change what is going to be asked of Dan Mullen to be in the national title contention from a recruiting standpoint. Like, you still have to be able to win head-to-head battles with Georgia, Alabama, Ohio State, and Clemson. And winning a head-to-head battle for a high school recruit is different than accepting a transfer from someone that had a situation that wasn't ideal for whatever reason. So, yeah, it makes them more talented. Like, it makes that roster more talented, but it still doesn't answer the question that needs to be asked of Dan Mullen in terms of elevating Florida from on the cusp of college football playoff contention to national title.
I agree with that. I do think eventually, and I don't know when this happens, but I do think as an industry, we will combine rank transfers and mm-hmm. recruits in the same class and just call it like the incoming player ratings or the new player rankings. Because some of these schools are using 5, 6, 7, 8 spots a year on transfers. And if you're going to use 35% of your available scholarships on transfers, then if we're just looking at the high school rankings, and for now, I think the high school rankings as a way to evaluate team recruiting is very accurate. But if the sport trends more that way, to where a significant portion of your teams are using 20, 30% of their available incoming scholarships on transfers, then I think in order to capture the entire picture, we need to consider that more. And Dan Mullen has done a really nice job in the portal. It's a way to supplement some recruiting shortcomings, as you said. It's not, in my opinion, a one-for-one substitute. I want to get a guy who's a stud in my program, into my culture from day one. This is very much the Dabo approach. You know, and granted, this is kind of a privileged college football approach. Like, if you're an awesome team, you can afford to do that. If you're not, you may need to take some more transfers. I don't think Bama has a whole lot of room for transfers this year because they have 26 guys in their class, and if they get JT, they'll have 27. But that's just something to look at. By the way, with all this, is not a question we got, but I was thinking about this. If you're an NFL team, would you rather have Urban Meyer or Dan Mullen as your coach?
Dan Mullen, probably.
I think so, because he's much more proven as far as winning without a talent advantage.
Yeah, and he is the offensive mind. And Urban Meyer, is his success has been built on this CEO executive approach to motivation and recruiting intensity and, you know, daily competition. And not that those things won't translate or can't translate in the NFL, but those feel like principles that build college football success more so than NFL success to me. Like, not that they're not applicable, but they are exactly how you build college football success. And I think the recipe is just tweaked a little bit in the NFL. And Dan Mullen, all these things we're talking about him with, like, you don't have to worry about that stuff in the NFL. Like, I think Dan Mullen would be potentially like one of the better college football hires to make that jump. I think Matt Rhule's got a chance to be a good one there. But like, I don't know, like Dan Mullen versus Lincoln Riley, everyone's talking about Lincoln Riley. I'm not convinced Dan Mullen wouldn't be the more appealing candidate.
I agree. I mean, he's shown great versatility and adapting to his talent. And if I'm in the NFL, I want guys who succeed without the talent advantage, because you can't take your recruiting ability to the NFL. And Meyer has always had, like, that's been the far and away the best thing he does is recruit talent. By far. I mean, he doesn't call plays. He never has. Let's take a quick break. And then when we return, we got a couple more questions to hit, and then we will go ahead and get out of here.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal.
Listen to The Deal on Spotify.
Hello, everyone. It's Mike Richards here. You might have seen me on CBS working on their Champions League coverage over the last couple of years. I wanted to tell you about an exciting new podcast that I've been working on. It's called The Rest Is Football. It's me, alongside Gary Lineker and Alan Shearer, two absolute legends of the game. The show combines topical debate from the world of soccer along with outrageous tales from our careers. And I mean outrageous. Just search The Rest Is Football wherever you get your podcasts. All the best from Big Meats.
All right, we're back on Barton and Bud. Appreciate you dropping us that 5-star review on Apple Podcast while we were on break. Barton, our next question comes from Chief Dog 10, who asks, which quarterback should come back to avoid this unusually strong quarterback class in the draft, which of course includes Trevor Lawrence, most like Zach Wilson, probably Justin Fields, I assume.
Trey Lance. So
right. I mean, who are some guys you think who should come back, who maybe would consider turning pro in a normal year, who might be able to elevate their stock just by, you know, having a less stacked field next year?
Well, right. Or a guy that would be forced to go pro in a normal year, but has the option now to get that initial additional year of eligibility due to the COVID waivers. So I kind of dug around. Like, I think Derek King is making a smart decision. If he actually wants to play quarterback in college, Derek King, Miami, has announced he is coming back, which was a little bit of a surprise to me. I just assumed at this point, you are what you are. You know, if you want to play quarterback, you're still an undersized quarterback, still going to be a long shot for these NFL guys that want the prototypes. But with all that other crew out of the way next year, with coming back to a good Miami team, with Rhett Lashley still there, the offensive coordinator, you know, he'll have a chance. And again, the media landscape will be different. The COVID narrative will be out of the way. People will just be focused on the ball a little bit more. I think he's got a chance to up his stock a little bit. And it doesn't mean he's going to be a first round pick, but at least make some moves. So I was surprised and sort of pleased to see the Derek King news. Some of these other guys, whatever, like if they want to come back and play another year because it's fun and college football is fun. But I don't know that their stock is going to change a whole lot. Like a Sam Ehlinger, like your stock is what it is. Or I don't know who else would be out there. But the one guy that comes to mind who's not going to be a first round pick, who I actually have no idea where this guy would be slotted, but would absolutely be leaving otherwise, is Kellen Mond. And I feel like Kellen Mond, because he has some very seductive quarterback traits. He has a lot of things that NFL personnel people are going to be excited about on the surface. And he's been maddeningly inconsistent throughout his career. He's had a solid year this year. Not always been the prettiest, but he has had a solid year. His best year yet, I would assume. I haven't looked at the numbers, but I got to believe this is his best year yet. If he comes back, because he's going to be a little bit more, quote, toolsy than some of the other guys that he would be compared against, which isn't the case this year necessarily. If he has another year of improvement under Jimbo Fisher, I think it would make a lot of sense for Kellen Mond to come back. And man, that'd be great for Texas A&M. Maybe Haynes King is the answer there, and he's the next up. He's the true freshman this year. But that's still a team that returns a lot of talent. They'll have questions at the quarterback position if Kellen Mond is gone. And if he comes back and settles those questions, then you know, maybe you got an A&M team that's contending for the playoffs, and maybe Kellen Mond with Fields and Wilson and Lance and Lawrence out of the way. I mean, he certainly has an elite ceiling. So I would be very intrigued by the narrative around Kellen Mond next fall if he came back.
I like that. And I have a similar one in mind here. So Kellen Mond, he lost Osmond to opt out. They lost Brown to injury. They lost another guy to injury. That receiving core for A&M didn't scare anybody. They have some young talent there. Mond could absolutely put up some better numbers and some more explosive numbers, I think, even in Jimbo's offense, which compared to the rest of college football has lagged behind now in recent years in explosiveness. I think him coming back would make a whole lot of sense. His year this year was good, but you know, not great. 7.6 per attempt sounds nice, but you got Mac Jones throwing for 11.4 per attempt. Matt Corral throwing 10-6 an attempt. I mean, 7-6 an attempt just doesn't really scare people. Here's another one for you, by the way, a guy who had a similar issue where you lost a guy to the draft in Chase Claypool. Then you had the dudes who were expected to be receivers got hurt, right? I mean, their starters were going to be Kevin Austin and Braden Lindsey. We just did the podcast on how Nick Saban's probably not that scared of Alabama because of Notre Dame. Because Notre Dame's receivers don't scare anybody. And he's like, all right, Josh Joe, Pat Surtain, awesome job. Go out there, play singles for about 75% of these snaps, and we're just gonna, you know, be able to load the box and still play some, you know, some cover three and not allow explosive plays and blah, 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 blah. If Notre Dame has better receivers next year, I could see Ian Book coming back the second year in the Tommy Rees offense and maybe improving. I right now I don't know that he's an NFL guy.
I think he's
not
a
draftable dude.
I disagree with that. I do think he is a fifth, sixth kind of guy, maybe fourth. Like I do think he is, but, and I could be wrong, but that would be my expectation, but I don't disagree with your point. Like it's kind of interesting, you know, I feel like he's been in college football forever already. If he were to come back again for another season, but you're right. I mean, I thought Ian Book was at his ceiling last year. I thought Ian Book was what he was, and this year he has been better. And I still kind of think he's at his ceiling this year. You know, he's maybe a late round draftable guy. He can make a roster. He could be a career backup or a backup for 6 years or something like that. And so go ahead and get your earning power now, get out there and get cash a few checks. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe his ceiling, he's got a little more to go. Just like he surprised me this year by getting a little bit better. If he gets a little better next year, has some more options to throw to, maybe he's a third rounder. Maybe he's a second. I don't know. Like I think that's an interesting one. I kind of thought about that as well. It's funny to think about him coming back again, but it'll be an interesting choice for him.
I've got a couple more I want to throw out here. Davis Mills is a dude who I think has some talent. Stanford had such a disjointed year this year. They weren't even allowed to practice with the ball.
Would this be his last year otherwise?
So he's technically a senior. So yeah, he'd be using his COVID senior, according to CFBstats.com. This is where I'm looking off. I just kind of sorted it by yards per attempt.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I have an interesting comparison I want to throw by you. So in 2000 and I think it was 2010, NC State had this guy named Mike Glennon. And they thought he was the heir apparent, and they knew they were going to get multiple years out of him, and they thought he was going to be pretty damn good. And ultimately, they were right. He was pretty damn good. And he ended up starting for the Bucks for a while in the NFL. But they kind of pushed out this guy named Russell Wilson, right? And I'm sitting here, I'm looking at the guy who is number one in the country in yards per attempt, who is listed as a redshirt junior, who might win the Heisman. I think Mac Jones needs to go, right?
Oh, definitely.
Like he's going to go. There's no real conversation about him coming back and maybe having the issue with Bryce Young, right? Like, has he announced he's going?
I have not seen that, but that would be crazy if he came back, right?
Cool. All right, just want to make sure he is for sure going. Yeah.
I mean, he's not going to have a better year next year than this year because he's been
that's what I'm perfect too.
Yeah.
You know, Shane Buechele, I think probably he's shown everything he needs to show. I'm just kind of going down the list here of guys. Kyle Trask, I mean, given that they're not going to have Pitts, Grimes, or Tony next year, probably needs to take it on down the road.
He's like Mac Jones, too. It's like, what more can you do? Like, you are what you are, and you had a damn near perfect season. So
exactly. Other guys. Brady White, I mean, if he doesn't go now, like,
he's going to draw Social Security. I think he announced he's done it at Memphis. I don't know what that means. I guess it means he's going. But, yeah, this is like – I feel like it's year six with him anyway, so he'd be year seven, I think.
He's like about as old as us, dude.
No, man.
Like Brady White was, I feel like he was at the same Elite 11 as like Josh Rosen.
Right. He was the Rosen Darnold year. So those
guys. Wait, he actually was? I was trying to think. Like,
I'm pretty sure he was.
I said it as a joke almost, but that might really be true.
I'm pretty sure that he was. I'm looking it up right now. He was class of 2015 with Josh Rosen and
Darnold and
Drew Locke and, you know, these guys that have been in the league for like 3 or 4 years now, it seems like.
That's awesome. Oh, man. Good question for sure there. All right. What do we have next year? It's Marco Franco.
Okay. Marco Franco asks, thoughts on the overall job Pat Narduzzi has done at Pitt and the future of that program going forward. So I think that Pat Narduzzi is a perfect coach for Pitt. I think that they're tough. I think they're physical. I think they're what a Pitt team needs to look like. I think they have arrived as a Pat Narduzzi team. I don't think they're ever going to be contending for ACC championships regularly. We'll get into the game every once in a while when things hit. But I think that's great. I think he's a great fit. I think he fits the culture. I think he fits the tone of the program. Tough, hard-nosed, blue-collar type of guy. Defensive coordinator. They're going to play good defense. They're going to be nasty. And yet, I don't know that they're ever going to be contending national titles there. But that's okay. I don't think every program has to sort of be looking for national titles. So I'm with it, man.
Pat Narduzzi has had a winning record in the ACC in 3 of his 5 seasons. And another one of his 5 seasons, he went 4-4. What did they do this year? They losing record by a little bit, I think.
Yeah, I don't know.
I know they went 6-5.
Yeah.
And I mean, so that's obviously 5-5 in the league. So he has had a 500 or better record in the ACC 5 of 6 years. And this year he did it with an injury to Kenny Pickett, who was playing, you know, very well. They've developed players well. I think they recruit to their scheme well. And like you said, they're tough. I don't know what more you want. I mean, Pitt under Pat Narduzzi, I think, is much closer to its ceiling than Pitt's floor, in my opinion. I mean, you hired the wrong coach at Pitt, you could easily go 3-5 in the league consistently.
Agreed.
Just in my opinion there.
There's enough teams. I think you found your guy at Pitt.
Yeah, apparently some people there are not super happy.
Really?
Again, it's what we got back to with expectations. Like, what more do you want? This is kind of the classic Glenn Mason thing. When Minnesota got tired of going, you know, 8-4, 9-3, you're freaking Minnesota, man. Like, what are we doing?
Yeah. This is,
got to capitalize on that St. Paul and Minneapolis town a little better, I guess. All right. I think this Larry Scott one's going to take way too long, and I really don't know how they're going to get Larry Scott
out. I don't know how to answer that question anyways. There's a question about getting Larry Scott out as a Pac-12 commissioner and Conley World. We'll save that one for another day. Do you want to finish on Andrew Rubin?
Yeah, I think that, like, and we kind of tackled this in the last show. Like, I'm not convinced that an 8-team playoff drastically increases the odds that other teams will win the playoff. We still have the issue in college football of, you know, my worry at least, of the sport becoming too regional. And if it just is entirely regional forever, it dies, right? Like, we need to make sure this sport maintains some level of national interest. We actually talked about this 2 episodes ago, pretty at length. But could an 8-team playoff even out recruiting, Andrew wants to know, and get the second tier programs closer to the top ones? I don't see a way that it would hurt. To be able to say, hey, we made the playoff, even if you get, you know, drug, it still helps to be able to say you made it. So I think the answer is yeah.
Agreed.
Am I missing something there?
I think that the putting up banner or a flag up at your stadium that said playoff 2022, like, that might get you a recruit or two. It doesn't matter, you got beat 45-10. You don't have to put that on the banner. Say we've gotten the playoffs. That's something. I think that's, I mean, it's just like saying playoff, like, you see it on the resume for, like, even if you are the perennial group of 5 team, that gives you opportunity, I think. You know, even if you are the perennial Pac-12 team, like, you're on that stage, you're in that program, you're in that setting. If you get pounded a couple times, whatever, like, you're pitching your kids and you got a chance to play for a national title. I think it would be the best teams are still going to get the best players. Like, that doesn't change. But I think you can make a case a little bit more to maybe stay at home, or, hey, this opportunity's here for you. We got a chance to play for the playoffs. You know, come help us take the next step or whatever. Like, I do think that promise can be compelling.
The comparison here also might be, think about the recruiting boost it is for some of these programs that make the NCAA tournament in basketball, right? They don't win it, but it's something to be say, hey, we made the tournament. We made the tournament 3 of the last 4 years. People don't say, what'd you do in the tournament? They say, oh, cool, man. Like, this is a tournament team. That's a cool thing.
Mm-hmm.
Let's end here on the Ted G question. And I think there's a broader question to be asked here. He says, isn't it reasonable to expect West Virginia to be number 3 in the Big 12 every year based on its history and the history of other programs? And we've discussed on this show Rutgers, not today's episode, but prior, you know, Rutgers talk, Miami talk, Boston College talk today, Pitt talk today. And I really think that there's a consistent theme among the questions we get of fans whose teams were involved in conference expansion over the last 10 to 15 years. and that is a lack of contextualization as to their success that they achieved, and Louisville as well in here, right? That they achieved in the latter years of those watered down leagues as schools started to get kind of picked off, right? You know, Louisville winning the Big East under Charlie Strong and not having that same success coming over to the ACC. TCU going undefeated in the old Mountain West and not being able to do the same thing for the most part in the Big 12. Same with Utah, although they you know, certainly won the Pac-12 or come close to doing, I believe. Ted asks, isn't it reasonable to expect West Virginia to be number three in the Big 12 every year based on its history and the history of their programs? I don't see that, personally. I think a lot of the West Virginia success they had under Rich Rod had to do with who they were playing on an annual basis. They had good talent, but number three just seems a little high to me, right? As an expectation, are you seeing what I'm seeing there?
Well, I can't really peg West Virginia. I got a hard time with that one because I still think it's a bit out of place geographically. It's playing outside of its footprint. And I mean, I don't know, like Kansas State's resume might be better equipped to be slotted in the third spot. That's a hard one for me. I think West Virginia can be the third best team in the conference. I think that they have probably a higher ceiling than maybe it's acknowledged sometimes, but the expectation thing, I don't know, man. I think if you're third there every year, like you're punching above your weight. I feel like you're exceeding expectations. It's a possibility, but you're accomplishing something that is a tall ask.
Top half to me, if you do it consistently, is success.
Right.
I mean, almost all of your recruiting is out of state. It's not impossible, but it's certainly not easy.
Mm-hmm.
All right, dude, we're up against it. We have a football recruiting rankings meeting coming up, and we'll go ahead and get to that. We'll get this off to our producer, Jordan, and we'll see you guys next week.
Later.
It's the NFL offseason, but on Pick 6, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, the football season never stops. Hosts Will Brinson, John Breach, and Tyler Sullivan are joined by analysts like Brady Quinn, Leslie Deuceable, Katie Mox, and RJ White to keep you in the loop on everything happening around the league. Whether it's free agents signing with new teams, the all-important NFL draft, or schedule release day, Pick 6 has you covered. As the face of the league changes with every team move and player pickup this spring, Pick 6 is a must listen. Download and follow on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Odyssey app, and anywhere podcasts are found.